So Justice Stevens needs no introduction. But I need to say a few things. There's a book coming out October 5th. It's entitled Five Chiefs. I very much wish we could be selling it to you all and you could get it signed. But we're going to relieve the justice of signing, but not of your obligation to buy it. Just from the brief introduction I got, it's going to be an amazing read. Justice Stevens is eloquent, brilliant, and has a very good sense of humor. So I do recommend it to you all. I want to briefly talk not about five chiefs, but about three justices. The first one is Justice Wiley Rutledge, who in the annals of history probably gets a short shrift for his contribution to American law and jurisprudence. But for us here at Colorado Law, he has a special role. He was one of our students. He was one of our faculty members. Word has it, I'm not sure where Dennis Hutchinson is sitting. I just heard his laugh. Word has it from Dennis that his grandfather, the Hutchinson, Black, and Cook firm, formerly known as something else, had hired him as a bright young lawyer, only to conclude that his skills were better suited for the academy, and so after a couple years came over to join the law faculty. He then went on to University of Washington in St. Louis, where he became friends with a reporter, and he also became, I believe, the dean there, right, before he went on to University of Iowa. Among other things, he supported President Roosevelt's court packing plan, not a popular position in the academy, and he found himself on the D.C. Circuit. And then, I take it from a good source, there were two choices for an open seat. A seat, I believe, was it Burns' seat that was
vacant? Yes, right.
I think Burns became Secretary of State or something, and there was an open seat. Roosevelt said, well, I have these two choices. There's this Judge Learned Hand. And there's this guy who went to Colorado Law School, Wiley Rutledge. You know, Hand has a lot going for him. He's an accomplished jurist, some would say one of the greatest appellate judges of the 20th century. But Rutledge is younger. And as it turned out, Wiley Rutledge only lived about 6 or 5 years after he was appointed, and Hand lived well beyond that. But thanks to that decision, Colorado law has one of its own in Supreme Court history, and there were some cases the year that Justice Stevens was clerking dealing with World War II questions about wartime and treatment of citizens, and one of my colleagues, also clerk for Judge David Ebell, wrote an article, and this is a former clerk as well of Justice Stevens, about how those cases influenced Stevens' jurisprudence. I know another influence on Justice Stevens is Justice White. And the Byron White Center for Constitutional Law is here because Byron White means so much to the University of Colorado. We can claim him as one of our own at the University of Colorado Law School, but we have to acknowledge he's adopted because he did go to Yale. However, he went to the University of Colorado for undergraduate and very much was a Coloradan. His son, Barney, can attest to that. And I had the honor of clerking for Justice White, and I know firsthand how much he adored Justice Stevens. They had a very close relationship. And so to have the Justice Stevens lectureship hosted by the Byron White Center is a very nice match. They are a nice match. Both of them were extremely practical. They had distinguished careers as practicing lawyers. They both actively believed in public service, in the law as an instrument of justice in society. And they also enjoyed sporting events together. I was just hearing about their golfing outings. Justice Stevens, like Justice White, cared a lot, and maybe I was an exception in this one, but because he actually took me on someone's recommendation, but he cared a lot about getting to know his clerks and picking clerks who were the nicest, smartest clerks out there. And he worked with them in an extremely collegial manner, and so many of us envied your clerks because of the experience they had with you and the relationship they had with you. The year after I clerked, I met Melissa Hart, who clerked for Justice Stevens, and who very much fits the mold of one of the nicest, smartest people I know. with a very strong public service mission. And so if you've not yet noticed what Melissa has been doing with the White Center, you should take notice. The events last week in Constitution Day and bringing the Constitution to people around the state is a great advertisement for how the University of Colorado Law has a public mission and has a director of the White Center who deeply believes in that. And this lecture series with distinguished jurist is a wonderful crown jewel for the law school. So we thank you for your inspiration, and we thank you for helping to deliver us Melissa. Your guidance to her is part of who she is, and she's a great part of us. So I'm going to turn it over to her to introduce you.
Thank you all very much for being here, and thank you, Phil. As Phil started to say before he realized that it sounded a little bit like he was bragging, but it would have been true, Justice White also selected among the nicest clerks one would ever want to know. So I want to say a little bit about the work of the White Center and then about the Stevens Lectures series as it will develop over the years, I hope. When Ira Rothgerber, who was a great alum and friend of CU Law School, gave the gift that created the White Center, he and then-Dean Jean Nickel agreed that a significant amount of work accomplished by the center will be directed toward the public at large rather than maintained inside the academy. Nickel wrote in a letter to Rothgerber, "If there is anything that the bicentennial taught, it is that Americans know precious little about their constitutional heritage." More than 20 years later, that public understanding of the Constitution remains a matter of grave concern. This year, thinking about that and thinking about what the White Center could do to try to address that, we did launch several new programs that sought to expand public conversation about the Constitution. One of them, as Phil mentioned, was the Constitution Day Project. Last week, and actually continuing tomorrow and later into September, we had more than 65 law students who went to high school classrooms all over the metro area and actually across Colorado in Fort Collins. We had hoped to go to Wellington High School, where Justice White graduated, but it is closed. So students went instead to Poudre High School, which is where Justice White would have gone if he graduated this year. We had students in Glenwood Springs. The entire Glenwood Springs High School got second period off to come listen to a talk on the Constitution. And in Colorado Springs, in Grand County, and later this month in Aspen. And the conversations have encouraged interaction between our law students and high school students and high school teachers about the Constitution, particularly about the First Amendment, and thinking about how to talk critically and analytically about the Constitution. Expanding on that, I have a group of students who have joined the National Marshall Brennan Constitutional Literacy Project, which is a project that was launched 13 years ago in Washington, D.C., and now has an international presence. Students have committed to spend the full year working in high school classrooms, again, teaching constitutional law and coaching high school students in a moot court competition that ultimately will lead to one team from the Colorado area going to Washington, D.C. to participate in this national competition. My hope is that these efforts will build on the success of the Center's Rothgerber Conference in taking the constitutional conversation out of the academy and moving it into the public realm. The Stevens Lecture is also part of that effort. When I started thinking about things that the White Center could do to generate broader public conversation, it struck me that public confidence in the judiciary is far from what it should be. The politicization of the judicial confirmation process and calls for the removal of judges because of unpopular decisions really threaten the rule of law and threaten the foundation of our constitutional democracy. A greater public understanding of the judiciary and the process of judging is a fundamental need, I think. So it seemed to me that what CU could best do to contribute to that conversation was to create a lecture series that would bring a judge to Colorado each year to talk about the judiciary, the state of the judiciary, and the process of judging, to increase public understanding of the judiciary. Justice Stevens is the perfect inaugural speaker for the Stevens Lecture Series, partly because it's named for him, partly because he was such a good friend of Justice White's, and since the center is the Byron White Center, that seemed like a fitting tribute to Justice White. And partly, and I think most importantly, because he was such an extraordinary judge and then justice. He not only contributed significantly to the development of law in substantive areas that increased our attention to government accountability, that was a powerful voice for equality, but he also lived by certain principles of judging that I think embody what I hope people will better understand about the judiciary, the importance of explaining things clearly, the importance of confining your decisions to what the question presented is. The number of conversations I remember having with Justice Stevens where he would express frustration with the consequences of a decision, a prior decision that went well beyond the bounds of the question presented and caused all kinds of unnecessary trouble for future lawyers and future judges. And I have to say, as I teach civil procedure now, I find myself frequently thinking, if they just could have stopped there, that was all they needed to do. And I think that kind of ethic of judging is something that really does embody the best in judging and that the public needs to understand. So I'm going to stop talking and introduce Justice Stevens for the inaugural Stevens Lecture.
Thank you very much. I should say before I start, because otherwise you might be a little bit confused, and I really thought I was talking a lecture, one of the white lectures rather than the Stevens lecture, because this is my third opportunity to deliver the first of a series of lectures honoring a distinguished member of the legal community. On each of those occasions, the assignment has been especially rewarding because the honoree was not only a brilliant lawyer, and I was thinking of Byron White, but with a distinguished professional career, but also a personal friend. The first was Nathaniel Nathanson, my constitutional law professor, who taught me to beware of what he called glittering generalities. The second was Wisconsin's Tom Fairchild, former Chief Judge of the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, who ran against the infamous Joe McCarthy in the 1952 U.S. Senate race, and who taught me that the respect for precedent is generally far more important than a judge's appraisal of the merits of particular decisions. Today I shall say a few words about a truly great American hero, with whom I spent many hours sharing a golf cart during his years as a senior citizen. Federal judges who had the opportunity to meet Justice White in his chambers were always favorably impressed. I'm sure they all remembered not only his crushing handshake, but also the greeting that immediately followed, that immediately made them feel welcome. He would rise, extend his hand, and simply state, "Byron White." Years after their first meeting, my good friend, Senior Judge Bright of the Eighth Circuit, loved to recall his initial encounter with Byron, which began with this exchange: "Byron White, Myron Bright." Before joining the court in 1975, I had met Byron on two occasions. The first was in Pearl Harbor during World War II, when he was serving as an air combat intelligence officer on the staff of a carrier task force. It was after our meeting that the Bunker Hill was hit by a kamikaze attack in which Byron saved the lives of sailors buried under debris that no one else was strong enough to remove. I think Byron's experience as an intelligence officer seeking to understand the intent of the enemy on the basis of miscellaneous scraps of information may have influenced his approach to statutory interpretation after he became a judge. He firmly believed in using legislative history when appropriate. As he stated in a footnote quoting Chief Justice John Marshall, "Where the mind labors to discover the design of the legislature, it seizes everything from which aid can be derived." Byron's footnote was responding to a criticism of the court's use of legislative history that Justice Scalia had made in his concurring opinion. Justice Scalia's opinion noted that Justice Jackson had criticized the majority's use of legislative history in a separate opinion in 1953. Justice Jackson's primary criticism, however, was based on the inaccessibility of legislative history to lawyers outside Washington. Developments in electronic research since 1953 have pretty well eliminated those concerns of Justice Jackson, who, of course, was also expressing his own view rather than the view of the court. My second meeting with Byron was in his office at the Department of Justice when he was the Deputy Attorney General in the Kennedy administration. Working closely with Louis Oberdorfer, a former Yale classmate who had served as a law clerk for Justice Hugo Black when Byron was clerk for Chief Justice Vinson, Byron was leading an effort to select top lawyers in the Justice Department on the basis of their talent rather than their political sponsorship. Our conversation focused on the work of the Assistant Attorney General in charge of the Antitrust Division. My memory that we had similar views about antitrust and business law issues seems to have been confirmed by our approaches to such cases after we became colleagues. That similarity may explain Byron's decision as the senior justice in the majority at our conference on the Chevron case, which involved the deference owed by judges to agency interpretations of ambiguous statutes, to assign the opinion to me. If the number of times that opinion has been cited is evidence of its importance, I must thank Byron for blessing my career with that assignment. His career in the Justice Department came to an end in the spring of 1962 when President Kennedy selected him to fill the vacancy caused by Justice Whitaker's retirement. The Senate promptly confirmed Byron's nomination by voice vote, and on April 16, 1962, Chief Justice Earl Warren swore him in as an Associate Justice of the Supreme Court. Byron wrote opinions in at least two of the cases that were argued that week. In one of them, Continental Ore against Union Carbide and Carbon Corporation, which involved a private treble damage action under the antitrust laws, Byron wrote for a unanimous court in holding that the plaintiff was entitled to a new trial. Appropriately, the conspiracy alleged in that case was to restrain trade in certain ores mined principally on the Colorado Plateau. During his ensuing 31 years on the court, Byron wrote so many opinions in so many different areas that I cannot begin to summarize them adequately. Instead, I shall limit my remarks to two aspects of his jurisprudence that seem especially relevant today, and then comment on a case about which we disagreed. I shall begin with the Eighth Amendment because Byron wrote a dissent in an important case argued on his second day on the bench, Robinson against California, in which the court held that the rights protected by the Eighth Amendment were enforceable against state action. The question in Robinson, as framed in Justice Stewart's majority opinion, was whether a California statute making it a criminal offense for a person to be addicted to the use of a narcotics was unconstitutional. In their respective dissents, Justice Clark and Justice White disagreed with that formulation of the issue. But as Justice Harlan wrote in his concurrence, the trial judge's instructions to the jury permitted its members to find the defendant guilty on no more proof than that he was present in California while addicted to narcotics. Accepting the majority's interpretation of the instructions, the holding is surely correct. Even though a prison sentence for a narcotics offense may not be unusual, it would surely be cruel and unusual if it represented punishment for a medical condition that merely created a propensity to use narcotics. The fact that Byron dissented is of interest because he later wrote so many significant opinions condemning cruel and unusual punishment. For example, Byron was one of the five justices supporting the judgment in Furman against Georgia, which invalidated the death penalty as it was being administered in 1972. He also wrote the opinions for the plurality in Coker against Georgia and for the court in Edmund against Florida, which held respectively that death is an excessively severe punishment for raping an adult woman or for aiding and abetting a felony if the defendant neither took life nor attempted or intended to take it. And in my second year on the court, Byron wrote a compelling dissent to the court's holding in Ingraham against Wright, that the Eighth Amendment does not prohibit the corporal punishment in public schools, no matter how severe. While Byron disagreed with much of the reasoning in Justice Powell's opinion for the court in Ingraham, he made no dissent at all from Justice Powell's statement that the constitutional prohibitions against cruel and unusual punishment, quote, prescribe punishment grossly disproportionate to the severity of the crime. The validity of that proposition remained unchallenged until after Justice Scalia joined the court. I need help.
I need help.
You're tough. Good for you. Thank you. It then became the subject of debate in Harmon against Michigan, a case argued near the beginning and decided at the very end of the October 1990 Supreme Court term. Five justices wrote opinions, both Justice White's debate with Justice Scalia and his debate with Justice Kennedy merit comment. The case involved the constitutionality of a Michigan statute which provided for mandatory life imprisonment for possessing 672 grams of cocaine, an amount that would fit into the glove compartment of a car. Joined only by Chief Justice Rehnquist, Justice Scalia concluded that prior cases holding that the Eighth Amendment prohibits grossly disproportionate punishment should be overruled because the Eighth Amendment contains no proportionality guarantee. Justice Kennedy concluded that Justice Scalia's position was foreclosed by our earlier decisions, but concurred in the judgment because he was not convinced that Harmon's sentence was grossly disproportionate to the gravity of his crime. Writing for three of us in dissent, Justice White disagreed with both of them. Justice Scalia's 35-page opinion includes a scholarly description of the history that gave rise to the punishments against, quote, cruel and unusual punishments in the English Declaration of Rights in 1689. He argued that it was motivated primarily by the use of unauthorized and barbarous methods of punishment during the reign of James II. That interesting argument must have been primarily the product of Justice Scalia's own research, because neither of the briefs filed on behalf of the state of Michigan had advanced the argument that the Eighth Amendment did not contain any protection against disproportionately severe punishment. Those briefs did not cite the historical materials reviewed by Justice Scalia beyond briefly quoting the Ingraham majority summary of the history leading up to the English Bill of Rights. Among his responses to Justice Scalia's novel argument, Justice White relied persuasively on both plain language and common sense. A punishment of life imprisonment for overtime parking would be both cruel and unusual, as those words are commonly understood, and would be as offensive as punishing a criminal by the use of torture. Moreover, it is difficult to explain why the framers would prohibit excessive fines, as the Eighth Amendment does explicitly, but not excessive terms of imprisonment. Justice White also noted that other scholars interpreting the historical evidence had reached the opposite conclusion from Justice Scalia. That Justice White had the better of the argument over whether the Eighth Amendment contains a proportionality requirement is confirmed by a recent article by Professor Stiniford of the University of Florida Law School. Professor Stiniford is generally critical of the court's proportionality jurisprudence, but based on his extensive research, he concludes that each of the arguments advanced by Justice Scalia in his Harmon opinion is, quote, demonstrably incorrect. And then I summarize some of what he says in his article. While the professor endorses the court's answer to the threshold question of whether the Constitution requires proportionality review, he is highly critical of the way in which the court has conducted such review. He argues that proportionality should be defined in terms of retributive justice. The punishment should fit the crime, and excessiveness should be measured by prior practice. He thus takes a position with respect to not only the debate between Justice White and Justice Scalia, but the debate between Justice White and Justice Kennedy as well. His comments resemble reasoning in Justice White's dissent, which emphasized that the sentence imposed on Harmelin was harsher than that imposed for more serious crimes in the same jurisdiction or for the same crime in other jurisdictions. I then quote a little more from the professor's article, which I don't think I really need to read here. But I want to make two final comments about cruel and unusual punishment. First, if retribution is the purpose that justifies the death penalty, then as I explained in my separate writing in the Bays case, the court's jurisprudence that requires administrative death penalty to design not to inflict suffering has in fact made the penalty, to use Justice White's words, the pointless and needless extinction of life with only marginal contributions to any discernible social or public purpose. The extraordinary costs of administering the death penalty significantly outweigh its benefits. As my Bays opinion explained, that fact is particularly clear now that the primary justification for the penalty, the retributive impulse, is no longer satisfied by the penalty's clinical design, which avoids any penalty to the defendant. Second, if proportionality is constitutionally mandated, our policymakers should take a second look at the mandatory minimum sentencing statutes that are producing overcrowded prison populations throughout the country. Similarly, they should take a second look at the mandatory deportation statutes that preclude the formerly permitted discretion of judges to determine whether an alien who has lived in this country for decades should be deported as punishment for a relatively minor offense. In both situations, the mandatory nature of the statutes precludes judicial tailoring of the punishment to the lesser gravity of some covered offenses, which recreates the risk of excessive punishments in a surprisingly large number of cases. During my years on the court, I had the impression that Chief Justice Berger liked to write opinions in which the court favored First Amendment claims and to assign to Byron the task of writing opinions that members of the press could be expected to criticize. I shared some of Byron's views in some of those cases. Zurcher against Stanford Daly, a case decided not long after I joined the court, provides an example. In Zurcher, a Stanford University student newspaper had published an article with photographs of a student protest at the university hospital during which police officers had been assaulted. The police searched the newspaper's offices for other photographs that might reveal who had assaulted the officers, and the newspaper sued, claiming First and Fourth Amendment violations. The newspaper argued that the First Amendment required a per se rule, forbidding a warrant to search its office and permitting only a subpoena duces tecum. Byron wrote an opinion that rejected the newspaper's claims. I dissented on the Fourth Amendment issue of whether the police search of the newspaper's facilities was constitutional, but even though I did not join his opinion, I agreed with Byron that the First Amendment does not provide newspapers with a special immunity from the duty to produce evidence that other citizens must provide. During the summer after the Zurcher decision, I was in California visiting with one of my closest friends, Robert Jamplis, a doctor on the Stanford Hospital staff. He invited me to join him on his morning rounds because he thought one of his patients, a California trial judge, would enjoy meeting a member of the United States Supreme Court. It turned out that the patient was the judge who had issued the search warrant in the Zurcher case. because I think the chance to meet a judge on the court that had upheld his ruling and to express his enthusiastic approval of our work may have enhanced his rate of recovery. I thought it appropriate not to mention the fact that I had dissented in the case. The incident reminds me of an encounter between Byron and a critic of the court's First Amendment jurisprudence. At the beginning of Byron's talk to the Utah Bar Association in the summer of 1982, a member of the audience ran up to the front of the room and assaulted him. Of course, I can't imagine a worse person to assault. But in any event, the man's motivation was hostility to the court's cases protecting certain sexually explicit materials. He was obviously unaware of the fact that Justice White had been a dissenter in the cases that offended him the most. Thus, while the trial judge in Zurcher gave me credit for a decision from which I had dissented, Byron was attacked by a man who had probably agreed with his opinions. The most significant case that was pending when I joined the court in 1975 was Buckley against Vallejo, in which the court reviewed the constitutionality of the federal election campaign amendments of 1974. Byron wrote a separate opinion, effectively explaining why the distinction between limitations on contributions, which the court upheld, and limitations on expenditures, which the court invalidated, did not make much sense. He also persuasively explained why the court should have respected the congressional judgment that effective campaigns could be conducted within the limits established by the statute. As an introduction to his opinion, he correctly explained why the argument that money is speech, and therefore limiting the flow of money to a speaker violates the First Amendment, proves entirely too much. He predicted that the court's holding that a candidate has a constitutional right to spend unlimited amounts of money in an effort to be elected would unfortunately be interpreted as a holding that candidates have a constitutional right to purchase their election. Time has vindicated another of Byron's predictions, that, quote, without limits on total expenditures, campaign costs will inevitably and endlessly escalate. Byron was clearly correct when he explained why the First Amendment does not protect a candidate's right to make unlimited campaign expenditures. Such expenditures pay for many non-speech items, such as taking straw polls, planning campaign strategy, travel for campaign workers, and perhaps a candidate's wardrobe. Indeed, the fact that the money used to finance the Watergate burglary could be classified as a campaign expense would surely not entitle that expenditure to the protection of the First Amendment. As Byron pointed out, not only do expenditures finance activities other than speech, but history should have taught us that unlimited amounts of money tempt people to spend it on whatever money can buy to influence an election. Recognizing that financing unethical or illegal practices is low on every campaign organization's priority list, he argued that expenditure limits would play a significant role in preventing such practices because there would not be enough of, quote, that kind of money, unquote, to go around. Alluding to the scandals during the Nixon administration, he emphasized the importance of restoring and maintaining public confidence in federal elections. In his judgment, it was, quote, critical to obviate or dispel the impression that federal elections are purely and simply a function of money, unquote. And it was quite proper for Congress to do so by limiting the amount of money that a candidate or his family could spend on a campaign. In its response to Justice White, the majority simply and incorrectly assumed that limitations on expenditures could be equated with limitations on the amount of speech. Instead of asking whether the limitations set by Congress would impair a candidate's ability to conduct a fair campaign, the majority relied on the rhetorical flourish that, quote, the concept that government may restrict the speech of some elements of our society in order to enhance the relative voice of others is wholly foreign to the First Amendment, unquote. That colorful rhetoric assumes that limitations on the quantity of speech in public debates are just as obnoxious as limitations on the content of that speech. But there is nothing even arguably unfair about even-handed rules that limit how much speech can be voiced in certain times or places or by certain means such as sound trucks. If we view an election as a race between two competitors, or a species of debate between two adversaries, equalizing the amount of money that each contestant can spend in an attempt to persuade the decision makers is fully consistent with the First Amendment. Otherwise, appellate court rules limiting the time that the advocates spend in delivering their oral arguments would be invalid because such rules limit the speech of one adversary in order to enhance the relative voice of his or her opponent. Byron's opinions in Buckley against Vallejo and other election law cases make it clear that he would have agreed with my discussion of the First Amendment in the Citizens United campaign finance case over a year ago. In that case, the majority invalidated congressional limits on corporate expenditures in elections by rejecting the argument that speech of corporations or other associations should be treated differently from that of natural persons under the First Amendment. Writing for the four-justice minority, I concluded by emphasizing that the majority had thereby rejected, quote, the common sense of the American people who have recognized a need to prevent corporations from undermining self-government since the founding. In so doing, I wrote, quoting Justice White's dissent in the Bellotti case, the majority opinion, quote, elevates corporations to a level of deference which has not been seen since the days when substantive due process was regularly used to invalidate regulatory legislation thought to unfairly impinge upon established economic interests. While I have mentioned a few of the many cases in which I agreed with Byron's views, I think it appropriate to acknowledge that our friendship did not prevent either of us from disagreeing with the other. Our differing views on the abortion issue, for example, were set forth in our separate opinions in the Thornburg case, in which we disagreed as to the strength of the liberty interest implicated by a woman's decision not to bear a child, and as to whether the government interest in protecting fetal life is equally compelling at all moments from conception to birth. And of course, Justice White's veto was decisive in a host of cases in which he did not author an opinion. For example, Justice White joined part two of Justice Brennan's opinion in Monell against New York City Department of Social Services, and Justice Rehnquist's opinion in Oklahoma City against Tuttle in 1985. Those opinions announced the rule that a municipality cannot be held liable for a constitutional violation on a respondeat superior theory, which is the theory that an entity is liable for all violations committed by its employees in the regular course of their employment. As I argued in my dissent in Tuttle, the rule against that theory of government liability qualified as a judicial fiat, I guess, that no litigant has asked the court to decree. Two unusually important recent cases illustrate the need for a reexamination of that rule. In the first, Connick against Thompson, decided a few months ago, the Supreme Court overturned a judgment awarding damages to a man who had spent over 14 years on death row because prosecutors in the Orleans Parish District Attorney's Office flagrantly violated their duty to turn over exculpatory evidence to the accused. In the second, Vance against Rumsfeld, decided a few weeks ago by the Court of Appeals for the Seventh Circuit, the court considered whether American citizens who claimed to have been tortured at the hands of military personnel in Iraq had sufficiently alleged that the Secretary of Defense personally authorized that policy of torture. Under governing law, such allegations were necessary in order to proceed with their suit. The basis for the rule announced in Monell and Tuttle and applied in Connick was the court's interpretation of legislative history. That history concerned Congress' rejection of a proposed amendment to the statute now codified as Section 1983 of Title 42 of the U.S. Code. In the years since Tuttle, historians have reviewed the analysis relied upon in Monell. Five of those studies were succinctly summarized by Judge Posner in a case a few months ago as follows. Quote, for reasons based on what scholars agree are historical misunderstandings, which are not uncommon when judges play historian, the Supreme Court has held that municipalities are not liable for the torts of their employees under the strict liability doctrine of respondeat superior, as private employers are, unquote. I would add that the rule not only was based on a misreading of legislative history, but also, and more importantly, is manifestly unwise. The New Orleans Parish Attorney's Office should be responsible for the constitutional torts of its agents without requiring proof that their training was inadequate. Similarly, in the federal contest, the plaintiffs in Vance should be permitted to recover damages from the United States government for constitutional rights violations by its lower-level employees. Those plaintiffs should not have to resort, as they must under existing law, to claims that a former high-level official directly authorized or ordered those violations. The government itself, rather than retired officials, should provide an appropriate remedy to victims in meritorious cases. In a recent article in the Texas Journal on Civil Liberties and Civil Rights, Ivan Bodensteiner argues that court decisions narrowing state and municipal liability under Section 1983, quote, have effectively made constitutional rights second-class rights when compared to rights created by the common law. And this qualifies as a sort of damage that Congress needs to repair. His concern applies in the federal context as well. By statute, monetary recovery may be had against the United States for some violations of state law by its employees, but that coverage does not extend to violations of the highest law of the land, the Constitution. In a sense, then, this structure of our law places greater importance upon the former set of rights than the latter. I would add just three comments about the wisdom of respondeat superior or liability for constitutional torts committed by government officials. First, as the common law judges who fashioned the doctrine well knew, it provides a powerful continuing incentive for employers to ensure, through effective affirmative steps if necessary, that their employees do not commit violations. Two professors I quote discuss how it enforces public wisely. Second, application of respondeat superior would eliminate time-consuming and expensive controversies about the tortfeasor's training in countless 1983 suits. The current requirement to show a custom or practice of inadequate training necessitates costly investigation and discovery, which can burden both plaintiffs and the local governments from which they seek relief. Respondeat superior rule would eliminate that burden. Third, and by far the most important, such a rule would produce a just result in cases like Thompson's, in which there is no dispute that the plaintiff was harmed by conduct that flouted his constitutional rights. In such cases, it is proper that the government whose employees committed the violation should remedy them. At the time of his appointment, Byron responded to press inquiries about his judicial philosophy by succinctly stating that his job was, quote, to decide cases. One of the reasons why he was a great judge is that he did not have an agenda that he sought to achieve through his decisions. He took the cases one at a time, deciding each on the basis of an impartial and intelligent study of the relevant facts and law. His approach to the law was like his approach to golf, a game he loved. Byron enjoyed playing, practicing, and talking about golf. I particularly remember his tactful method of asking me about my game. He would never embarrass me by asking me what my score was. Instead, he would ask, how many pars did you get? Saying none doesn't hurt. If I were to answer a similar question about his work on the bench, I would conclude that his record in the hundreds of cases that he decided included an amazing number of pars and birdies, and even an occasional eagle. Thank you very much.
So we have a few minutes now for questions and answers, and I should have said at the outset, but forgot to, that in addition to those of us here in the courtroom, there are people in rooms upstairs on the second floor who have been watching this lecture, and as well, we have it projected at Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction, and people there are also able to ask questions, and what they're going to do is write them down on cards, or they... People in Grand Junction won't write them down on cards, but they are sending them by email to someone who's upstairs who will bring cards down so that we can have questions from both upstairs and across the state as well as people in the room. While we give the people upstairs and in Grand Junction a chance to get their questions down here, I think that we may be passing cards around in this room, but as well, if people want to raise their hands to ask some questions, I will call on people. And let the justice answer. Yes. The question is whether you feel that you'd like to comment on last night's execution of Mr. Davis. Given your conversation about cruel and unusual punishment?
Well, the only thing I would say is that I think the court has handled it very carefully. You may remember that the court remanded, in effect appointed a district judge to conduct an additional hearing and to take evidence, and on the basis of what the judge's findings were, I think the court had no option but to uphold the decision. I do think the case is an example of the costs involved, in effect, when there is some degree of uncertainty in a case, when it can't help but be troubled by the fact that the enforcement of the penalty is so final. And that's one of the reasons why I think the risk of mistake really argues very powerfully for putting an end to the penalty.
So, this question is from Israel in Colorado Mesa University in Grand Junction. He asks, what can or should be done about the politicization of the judicial system? It's a large question.
Well, of course, that's a complex, complex question because the judicial system. Give me my glasses. The judicial system includes both the federal system and the state system. And oh, I'm sorry.
Well, I'm the wrong person to have on electronics. So.
Well, so am I. I'm totally incompetent in that area. I have. Throughout my career on the court, I felt very strongly that life tenure is a matter of tremendous importance in protecting the judicial process. I've been opposed to judicial elections and popular election of judges every time I've had a chance to talk about it. I still feel that way very seriously, and I think that the whole campaign finance aspect makes the state judicial elections even more unwise than before, but that of course doesn't apply to the federal system, and I think we're fortunate not to have a politicization of the federal bench.
So this is, I appreciate people with good handwriting. This question, I think, comes from upstairs. How does institutional leadership from the chief or from an associate justice compel consensus among the justices? Have certain chiefs stood out in your mind in the court's history or in your career as excellent leaders?
I think the question may rest on the misunderstanding about the powers of the chief justice, if I'm not mistaken. The chief justice has one vote out of nine. And the chief is influential in the discussions, but so are all of the colleagues. And I may have not got the full thrust of the extent of the question, but That, frankly, is one of the points I make in the book. The chief is the first among equals, but he has certain unique powers, but does not have the power to control any of the other votes on the court.
I guess expanding on the question a little bit, do you think that the way that the chief either practically sets conference or sets conversation affects the likelihood of consensus, or that certain chiefs can set a tone that more favors consensus, or is that not really part of what the chief does?
Well, there is certain variation among cases the way the discussion proceeds, and certain chiefs have done a better job of presenting an impartial outline of the issues before the discussion proceeds. But I really don't think the comments of the chief really should be singled out any more than the comments of any other justice in terms of influencing what happens.
Okay. Are there other questions from Chris? He asked whether you felt like commenting on the constitutionality of the individual mandate in the Affordable Care Act.
No.
That seems quite sensible. Sarah? So the question is, you began by talking about the importance of precedent, but have also talked about the fact that you think that the court's jurisprudence on the death penalty is incorrect. And how do you determine when it's necessary to overturn precedent versus when it's simply your opinion?
That's one of the most difficult tasks a judge has, and a task that judges work with throughout their careers. You have to use judgment in certain cases, and of course, you give great importance to precedent. But I must say that Byron was one of those who really was a follower of precedent in many cases. I remember he was a strong dissenter in the Miranda case itself, and strongly believed the case had been incorrectly decided at the time. But as years passed, I think he became persuaded that there was more merit to the position than he originally recognized, and he later wrote a very important opinion, a case called Edwards against Arizona, in which he actually extended the protection of the Miranda warnings to a case in which a person has been given the warnings and asked for counsel, and then the police seek to reinterrogate him. He announced a rule about, and he also went along with a change in the rule on the peremptory challenges, where he'd written an opinion in the other direction earlier. So he was a strong believer in precedent, but he also, I think, on occasion agreed that the arguments were so powerful that the cases should be overruled, even though it had been on the books for quite a while. That's an area that it's difficult to say there's a bright line rule that compels adherence to stare decisis in every case or in no cases. It's a judgment is required in addressing that issue.
So one of the questions that came earlier, I think, relate. It's not about the death penalty, but more about the question of stare decisis. The author of the question asks why you changed your position on affirmative action.
Well, you know, it's very interesting. I guess there are thoughts that I've changed that, but I'm not really 100% sure I have. I'm not sure that any of the opinions that I wrote or joined earlier in my career, I was incorrect in doing so. The principal case was the, what was the federal, the... you know the name of it, In any event, Congress had passed a very slapdash statute which allocated certain contractual benefits on the basis of race without any reasoning or for the selections or what was going on. And I think that statute really I would still vote to hold that statute unconstitutional. The big change, I think, is not one that I made, but I think I wrote an opinion in the Wygant against Michigan or something involving a discharge policy by a high school in Jackson, Michigan, where they retained a few minority teachers and didn't discharge everybody in a totally colorblind fashion, but they did it in connection with carrying out the provisions in a union contract, and they did it focusing on the future rather than on the past, is whether you should not justify race-based preferences on the basis of on a theory of providing remedies for past sins, but rather if you think the program is one that provides a constructive goal for the future, it can be justified, such as assigning African-American police officers in districts of a municipality where their African-American population persists. It makes a lot of sense to think that's good police work, even though it has this race-based aspect to it. And I think if you look at the cases that have been cited over the years, I really haven't changed my views all that much. I think that I haven't identified a case I would have voted differently in.
Are there, Shahar?
I was wondering what your thoughts were on this, designating retired Supreme Court justices to sit on the bench when a current justice has to recuse him or herself.
So Shahar asked, what would you think of designating retired justices to sit on the court to hear cases in which a current justice has to recuse her or himself?
Well, I'm delighted that you asked that question. I've made that proposal. As a matter of kind of interesting, Bill Rehnquist and I both suggested that as a solution. I think it would make eminently good sense because theoretically, even after retirement, you have a person who's qualified to for the work. And I think I would think it should only be done, though, in cases in which the majority of the court feels it's appropriate. I think if there were a case which is quite clear the court is apt to split 4-4, I think the court would be wise to wait for another case to come along. But there are a lot of cases that are not ideological in context, construing statutories and things like that, in which I think the work of the court would be facilitated by allowing retired justices to sit on a temporary basis, as they do in so many state courts, as you know.
So another question from upstairs asks, how much attention, in your experience, does the court pay to the costs of the rules that it creates, the litigation costs of the rules that it creates?
Well, I think they always think about it. One of the differences between the judicial process and the legislative process is that we can't schedule hearings to determine what the policy consequences are, and so you have to make judgments, basically. But I think that is something that is appropriate to think about. As I suggested with regard to respondeat superior, I think that having such a rule in place would actually reduce the cost of litigation, and that would be an appropriate reason for favoring such a change.
So another question from upstairs. If you could have chosen a different career, what would you have liked to do?
Well, that's interesting because the dean reminded me that earlier this afternoon that I'd been asked that question some years ago, and I had a ready answer, which I still might think the same thing. I thought it would have been great to be commissioner of baseball. I represented a baseball club when I was in private practice, so I have some background there.
All right, I think maybe we can take one more question. Peter?
So I teach media, popular culture, and law. We're going to be talking about judges next week. So I was wondering, what do you thought about introducing intelligent fairness to the Supreme Court? Is that a good idea or a bad idea?
I'm
Wait, can you say that again?
Having more television coverage of the Supreme Court.
Oh, what do you think of having television coverage of Supreme Court arguments?
Well, that's another issue on which there are good arguments on both sides, and I have to confess my views have not been absolutely solid over the years. But the danger is that you have a process that's basically working well now. Let me put it the other way around. The benefit of televising would be that the public would have a better understanding of the work of the court and of the fact that the justices themselves are very well prepared and are very well to be admired about the way they go about processing the cases. I think it would be good for the court to have the country at large witness their performance in open court, because I've heard many, many people say that they've been favorably impressed after seeing an argument. But the other side of the coin, and I think this is the dominant view within the members of the court now, is that whenever you introduce television into a new public area, you're never 100% sure what its consequences will be. I remember going to a football game and wondering why were everybody standing around for a minute in the middle of a game, you know, it was a television commercial. And there's a danger that it would affect a process that is now working well. And there's a philosophy, don't fix it if it ain't broke. And so I think the justices are concerned that they don't quite know what might happen. There might be more questioning in order to make an impression for a television audience. Lawyers might act a little differently than in the setting they have now. And so there's a sort of a fear that it may do more harm than good. A response to that is that some states, particularly Florida, have done that, have televised for years, and it has not made much difference. But one reason for that's true is that these are not necessarily the most popular programs on TV. the arguments can be pretty darn dull. And I think, I don't mean to say that ours is a better show than the state courts, but I think it is true that more of the cases in the Supreme Court are high visibility cases in which there's more of a danger of a distracting influence. So it's a tough question. There are good arguments on both sides. And there was a time when I favored it. I thought also they might televise just the opinion announcements, for example, or the omissions of attorneys, something like that. But then there's Bill Renker would say, get the nose under the camel's tent, and you never know what's going to happen next. And so but it's an interesting, important question, but I can't give you a categorical answer.
Well, thank you very much, Justice Stevens.